குட் ஈவினிங் ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் சக திரு அப்பா கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய வெப் மீட்டிங் லைஃப் டிவைன் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். சார் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். இன்றைய சாப்டர் மைண்ட் ட்ரீம் அண்ட் ஹலூசினேஷன். இது வந்து ஒரு ஸ்பெஷல் மீட்டிங் மாதிரி அமைஞ்சிருக்கு. Now I am asking Gary to start this talk.
Good evening. We're a smaller group today, so that means you have to work harder. I would really like more participation, questions, comments, rather than just a long presentation. And that goes for the other centers too. I would invite you to please raise questions without waiting for the end of my presentation. Today we're on Book 2, Part 1, Chapter 5, Cosmic Illusion. In the original writing of Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo did not write any chapter about cosmic illusion. He went back, I can't remember when, but I think it may be more than 20 years after the original book. He wrote 3 extra chapters at that time, and 2 of them were on cosmic illusion. So I was discussing with Ranjani before the meeting, and I don't know, he's never said why he went back to write 2 chapters on something that he doesn't believe exists or something that isn't true. But my guess is, and it's strictly a guess, that after writing more than 1,000 pages to say that the world is real and everything is real, the response he must have gotten from those who read, which at that time were almost exclusively Indians, must have been that they were people constantly asking him, what about Maya? Having written 1,000 pages to say that Maya is not true, not Maya as it's understood, he felt that that wasn't enough. So he went and wrote another 60 or 70 pages about something that doesn't exist. So I was thinking, why should he do that? And the conclusion I came to is, we Americans are not known to be illusionists. And most of the world has never heard of the theory of cosmic illusion or Maya. But if you scratch the surface a little, I think all human beings are fundamentally illusionists. We have a common phrase in English, it's too good to be true. And if you think about that statement, it's too good to be true, it basically means that life can't be so nice as that. When Appa says every devotee can have 100 crores, most people, at least if not outwardly, inwardly, think it's too good to be true. So in that sense, we're all illusionists. Whereas if you really understand what Sri Aurobindo has written in Life Divine, the truth is better than anything we can conceive. Even if you write the most fantastic fairy tale ending or description of what the world really is, it cannot approach the truth. Because he says the truth is that all is divine. The truth is that all manifestations are creation of the divine, that what we call undivine, which is what we discussed in the last session, is only the result of our ignorance. And when if our ignorance is out of the way, we will see the truth that all is divine. And all that we consider undivine will disappear because it's a product of our ignorance, not a product of the reality itself. Our ignorance results from our being divided, separated from the truth, and that's what our mind does. Overcoming that division, our life, your life, will become divine. This is the message. So why does he write chapters on cosmic illusion? Because our mind does create the illusion of non-existence, the illusion that things are not real. And we have to understand the nature of that ignorance so we can come out of it. Think about the story. What was real to Darcy, Elizabeth, Jane, and Bingley at the beginning of the story? What was reality? Reality to Elizabeth was that I will probably never get married, but Jane is good and beautiful, and if anyone's going to be lucky enough to get married, it'll be her. And if she does get married without any money, without any dowry, the chances of a good marriage are almost zero. Darcy comes to Meryton as a very low place where he's coming just because his friend leased a house here. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with anybody. And if you talk about what is the reality to Darcy, the reality is I have come to a place I don't want to be with some very vulgar people, and I can't wait to go away, and it's a waste of my time. When Collins writes his letter to Mr. Bennett, and he reads it out, what is the reality to Mrs. Bennett? That man is coming to triumph over the fact that everything at Longbourn belongs to him because he has the entail. He's coming to take everything away from me. When Collins comes, what is he thinking the reality is? He thinks he's a great man, very important. He not only has the entail, he not only has the living, but he's got a patroness with a big chimney that costs £700 and so many windows and staircases, and aren't they lucky that I'm coming to their house? What was the reality? When Darcy left Rosings, what was the reality for Lizzie? What did she think of the future? I never want to see that man again. When Jane returned from London, what did she think the truth and the reality was? Surely I will never see Bingley again. When Darcy left Lizzie at Lambton Inn after she told him about the elopement, what did she think? Surely I will never see that man again. He wants to get out of here as quickly as possible. When Mr. Bennett received Mr. Gardner's letter announcing the marriage settlement, what did he think the truth and the reality was? And when Lady Catherine quarreled with Lizzie at Longbourn and then said, I'll go to London and tell my nephew, he'll know what to do, what did Lizzie think? Yes, Darcy will agree with everything she said. So what is real here? In fact, if you go through the story, you'll see that almost no character at any time in the story had a correct, real picture of what the future was going to be. Because, is it because life is an illusion? Or is it because we're steeped in ignorance? Think back to your own lives. Think back, according to your age, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, what did you think your life was going to be? And what is it today? How much were you able to see then where you would be today? If you don't score any better than the characters in the story, then are you any more qualified to predict what the next 5 years will be? Are you any more qualified to think that you know what your future will be? The main problem for us is we are as ignorant as all the characters in the story. They didn't know they were ignorant, and we don't know that we're ignorant. And we think we have an idea about what the future will be because we do live in an illusion. We live in an illusion that we know something. It's not surprising that we don't know, because that's the nature of mind. The very nature of mind is that it's uncertain. The character of mind is it's not really sure of anything. Sri Aurobindo tells us here that if you look at mind not in the individual, but if you look at mind in the society, you'll see that mind goes through a period of oscillation, just like the pendulum on the clock. And at one time it says very insistently that this is the truth. And after some more time, it may be 10 years or 1,000 years, it says, no, that is the truth and this is an illusion. The very opposite, it comes to the conclusion. Science that we have today, all the great famous scientists founded modern science, like Sir Isaac Newton, believed in God, believed in the truth of the spirit. Today, if you're a scientist, please don't talk that nonsense. We know that that's all an illusion. What's true is the atom and the molecule and the gene, these things are true. That doesn't exist. It's a negation. For them, it's not the cosmic illusion, it's the spiritual illusion. The spirit is an illusion. In the Indian tradition, a few thousand years ago, or actually for Shankara about 1,200 years ago, he went to the other extreme. He said, spirit is real, spirit is absolutely real. It's the world, it's life that's the illusion and doesn't really exist. For those who have had spiritual experience, the scientist seems to be a child. For those who believe in the reality of the world that we live in, what Shankara was thinking is unimaginable, and how could anybody convince himself or anybody else that the world doesn't exist? It seems unbelievable, because that's the nature of mind. If you look in the story again, you'll see Darcy, when he proposed to her at Hunsford, was absolutely sure she's going to accept. In fact, he thought she's waiting for it eagerly. Certainly, he lived in an illusion, and his illusion was popped. The bubble was popped when she told him, you're the last man on earth. I decided the first month that I knew you that you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. What type of illusion he was living in. And then again, when he left her at Lambton, she was in the same illusion. So I conclude that the reason Sri Aurobindo wrote these chapters was not so much because he's very eager to dispel the illusion of Shankara, but he's eager to root out the depths of illusion that are there in the human mind. We have to give up faith in this mind, which is capable of affirming anything and capable of denying anything. That's most humorously represented when you find somebody arguing insistently for a particular cause or a particular goal or a decision. And then when they find out it's in their interest to do something else, they can equally well argue for the very opposite. It's best seen among the lawyers in the court. Because they can act as if they're ready to die and swear that their client is true and their cause is true. And if the other man had hired him 5 minutes earlier, he would be arguing in just the opposite way. Our mind is like that. We have to come out of it. Apart from that, he says that the sense of illusionism is so deeply rooted in the Indian psyche that even his writing 1,000 pages is not enough to root it out. So he has written more. That's very important because what his message is in Life Divine is the exact opposite of illusionism. It is spiritual realism. It is that the spirit is real and the spirit in everything is real. And therefore, if he has taken the pains to write not one but two chapters on this, it's worth our while really trying to see the ignorance that he's trying to root out in the human consciousness by this effort. The problem for us is the thinking mind. He says it's an ignorant dealer in possibilities. Yes, this is possible, but that's also possible. It sounds and tests each possibility. It strives to choose whether something's real or not. When Bingley comes and dances with Jane, yes, it's a possibility. When he goes to London, no, it's not a possibility. But we never know the certainty. We questioned even the actual fact. Lizzie, who knows Wickham, she's not able to figure out, is he good or is he bad? At first, he's sure he's very good. Later, she's sure he's very bad. Even after Jane knows all the facts, no, I can't get myself to accept either one. That is the character of mine. Bingley's not able to tell whether Jane loves him or not. He thought she's smiling, she's dancing with him, she's enjoying herself, but the moment Darcy comes in and says, no, she doesn't love you. She's never, I've been watching her. She doesn't really love you. He immediately accepted that he was wrong. This is our physical mind that's like that. But our life is also like that. We're not able to know what's the purpose of our life, what's the aim of our life, whether the decisions we've taken are right, whether we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, whether we're going in the right direction or not. They've created whole philosophies about this in the West called existentialism to say there's no right and wrong. It's anything you decide. There's no truth at all. If you see Trace Darcy's attitude to Lizzie throughout the story, you'll see that his view is constantly changing. His idea of the reality is constantly changing. First, he thinks she's tolerable, by which is a polite word for saying, as far as I'm concerned, she's not tolerable. She's not desirable. Then he begins to admire her fine eyes. Later, he's admiring the fact that she's a good reader and she's lively and she's cheerful, and then that she's so devoted to her sister, until he comes to the conclusion he can't live without her, but thinks that she can't live without him either, and then finds out that that's not right. And up until the last second, when he proposes to her the second time, he doesn't know whether she's going to accept him. He may have saved Lydia. He may have spent so many thousands of pounds. He may have come back. He still doesn't know what's going to happen. He says, well, my feelings for you have not changed. But if you still feel the same way you did at Hunsford, you need only tell me, you need not repeat your arguments. I will accept and I won't raise the topic again. It's a real doubt for him. This is the nature of mind. This is the quandary. This is the dilemma that we're in. That's why Mother says the very first rule of psychic education, the very first rule is you have to give up your faith in the mind's externalized way of looking at things. Meaning, thinking, trying to know and think you can know with this instrument, it's like trying to see with your ears or hear with your eyes. It's not a question, no matter how hard you strain your ears, you're not going to see. The problem is with the instrument. You're using the wrong instrument if you want to know things. He tells us that we live in the physical mind. We actually, he's going to tell us we have three minds. We have a physical mind, a vital mind, and a thinking mind. All of them are problems. But for the thinking mind, the only thing that's real is the physical mind. The only thing that's real is what is actually there in front of you at the moment. If you're leaving your house and you go and lock the door and you walk down to the street, suddenly the physical mind will say, did I lock the door? I think I did. I must have. I should have. Somebody was telling yesterday, maybe it came at the meeting. I don't know. I hear so many stories in the meetings. In our call last night, somebody was mentioning, did it come up at your Sunday meeting about somebody who left their whole office unlocked for the night? That's not the physical mind, that's the absence of the physical mind. Right. For the physical mind, possibilities don't exist. Nothing exists except what's there right in front of you. The famous phrase is, I'll believe it when I see it. But many people won't believe it even when they see it, even if you get the check for 100 crores. Is it real? Is it real? Is it really mine? That's the physical mind. It denies every time you think, I could get that, or somebody says, you can have that. No, no, not for me. I don't believe it. That's the physical mind. All the things that are subjective, it discards. It only believes in the material thing. So for the physical mind, love means to show my love, I have to give a gift. Yeah, he doesn't love me. He didn't give me a gift. Gift is love. That's the physical version. There were scientists in Germany who wanted to prove that the soul doesn't exist. So they dissected a dead body and searched everywhere and showed that there's no soul, no sign of the soul. That's the physical mind. The scientist is not able to see thoughts. Even with their most powerful microscope, they're not able to see thoughts. They're not able to see emotions. So they've concluded thoughts are not real, emotions are not real, only chemistry, only chemicals are there. Only nerve impulses are there because we can't see it. If we could see it, then we could know it was true. Physical science, which has done so much, has been had such an impact, is based on this idea that only what is physical is real. That's the basic premise. Only what is physical is real. It's the physical mind. We also have a life mind, a vital mentality. The vital mind doesn't worry about what is. It only thinks about what it wants. Think Mrs. Bennett, and you'll understand fully. The reality for Mrs. Bennett is not what is. The reality for Mrs. Bennett is what she wants. It thinks of possibilities. The moment she hears that Bingley has come and let Netherfield, oh, he's come. He can marry one of my daughters. That's the vital mind. It thinks of possibilities. It hunts for something that it doesn't have. It's never satisfied with the physical reality that's there. It's always either thinking it could get better or fearing it could get worse. If things are very good, it immediately says, I don't think it can last. Things can't go on being so good as this. That's the vital mind. It's always imagining something or other. When Charlotte thinks about marriage, she's thinking with the physical mind. Marriage means, she says, I'm not a romantic person. For me, marriage means a house, security, social respectability, and lots of chickens in the backyard. That's the physical mind. For Lizzie, she's thinking romance. No, I don't want just a man. I don't just want that security. I want something more. Something that she didn't find in her own home. Something she didn't see between Mr. and Mrs. Bennett. She thinks of getting something that doesn't exist. That's the vital mind. It's never satisfied, it's never quiet, it's always seeking something that's not there. Then we have the thinking mind. It simply questions everything. It questions the reality of what is, it questions the reality or the hope or the possibility of what might be. Builds up dreams of something better, and then it argues why that isn't true or why that can't be true. It erects philosophies to support something, and then it erects philosophies to destroy or cancel it out. Lizzie, who had erected a an unshakable case favoring Wickham, supporting Wickham as a hero, and classifying Darcy as a devil. After she reads the letter of Darcy at Hunsford, she reconstructs the whole thing, and she makes Wickham the devil and Darcy the hero. This is the capacity of the thinking mind to reframe reality from one perspective to another. And we've been doing it. Humanity's been doing it for thousands of years, and we've been doing it our whole lives, constructing one version and then moving, giving it up, getting disillusioned with it, and constructing another version. What's clear from all of this is that things are not what they appear to be. Things are never what they appear to be. Even when we prove that something is not true, we immediately think the opposite is true. And we end up in another illusion. In the story, towards the end of the story, when Darcy and Bingley come to Longbourn for the first time, there's a beautiful scene in the movie. Mrs. Bennet is lying on the sofa. There's food spread. The clothes are spread. Everything's in a mess. And as soon as they get word that Bingley's coming, they quick tie everything up, hide everything under the cupboard, sofa, and sit down very calmly and elegantly and gracefully, as if they've been sitting there like perfect angels all afternoon when they come in. This is a conscious illusion that we try to create, a conscious appearance. Jane does her best to never appear to be interested in Bingley. She's interested in Bingley from the first time she sees him. She wants him very much. But her training is, I should never appear to really want him. She did such a good job of it that he was convinced that she doesn't care. But it's an illusion. Wickham has another capacity for illusion. He constantly gives us the impression he's a good man. He's a handsome man, he's a cheerful man, he's a good man. But it's simply a conscious illusion. When Bingley goes to London and Carolyn writes to Jane, she explains why Bingley is going away, because he's going to marry with Georgiana, and how happy she is. And Jane is convinced that Carolyn is very sincere about it, when it's completely an illusion that Carolyn is trying to create to separate Bingley and Jane. These are conscious efforts at concealment. We all do it in one way or another, innocently or mischievously. But there's also the illusions we create ignorantly. Those are more serious. What does Darcy think of himself? When he comes to Meryton, he thinks that he's the most magnificent, special person in the world, and all of these people are so low that he need not even give any attention to them. Oh, I have not come to Meryton to pay attention to girls who are slighted by other men. That's what he says. What does he think of himself? He thinks of himself so great. We know what Collins thinks of himself because he's always telling us how he flatters himself. He's so proud. He thinks he's so clever and so charming and so cultured when everybody else thinks he's a fool. What does Lizzie think of herself? When she reads the letter at Hunsford, the biggest shock she has is not about Wickham. or about Darcy. She's shocked, definitely, to find out that Wickham is such a scoundrel and Darcy's really a good man. But that's not what's bothering her. What really bothers her is that she didn't know herself. She said, till now I have never known myself. I have been absurd. I've been acting like a fool. She didn't know she was capable of that. She was ignorant about herself. Darcy's behavior, which seemed to be offensive, proud, arrogant, resentful, she discovers later he's actually a good man. Doesn't mean his behavior was very pardonable, but his behavior was not the reality for him. The reality was something else. Darcy discovers something about himself that he never knew when Lizzie tells him outright, you've been selfish, mean, arrogant, boorish, ungentlemanly. It was a huge shock to him. These are the capacities. There's no sense blaming the characters and there's no sense blaming us. This is what we have. We have our physical mind, a vital mind, and a thinking mind, and we're trying to function with that, and we're trying to think and decide things with that. Well, it's not surprising then that at some times we begin to doubt our certitude. After observing enough our own life, personally or collectively, comes a time when we begin to doubt our own convictions and question everything. So I was wrong about that, I was wrong about that, he also was wrong about this, they were wrong about that, we're all wrong about everything, then that means nobody knows nothing, you can't be sure of anything. How can we even be sure that the world is real? The ultimate negation comes. The vital goes through these periods of doubting. We get depressed. One day we're exhilarated, I'm going to marry that man, or I'm going to be rich, or I'm going to be famous, or something like that. And then when something goes wrong, it's all an illusion. You can't rely on anybody. Nobody can be believed. Whatever they say, life is an illusion, life is a dream. These are things, I was foolish, I was young, I was idealistic, I was carried away, I was easily persuaded. When we get older, we convince ourselves that we're now foolish anymore. We even tell the young people, oh, you're young, you talk silly like that, you believe so many things, but we know better. We become illusionists. And we'll be happy to tell our children and our grandchildren that when you grow up, you'll also find out that all of this nonsense, it's all of this nonsense. I can save you a lot of time. You can also become an illusionist and not believe anything. It was all a dream. This is the vital frustration when it doesn't get what it wants. Instead of saying, I didn't get what I want, we create a philosophy of life and say that nobody gets what they want because life is like that. Life is not meant for getting what you want. Life is meant for suffering and disappointment. And if you think you're famous today, you watch tomorrow, everybody will turn their back on you and talk against you. And then you'll see it was an illusion. This capacity for negation, we have a capacity for affirmation. Wickham, anybody who's this handsome must be true. We equally have a capacity for negation. Never trust a handsome man or a pretty woman or a rich man or a poor man or whoever it is, or a government official or somebody else. We have so many pieces of wisdom in our mind because we've been disillusioned of so many illusions by creating new ones. So it's not surprising that sometime in human history, somewhere, somebody should come up with the ultimate illusion, the ultimate negation. And Buddha did it about 2,000 years ago in India when he said, all of life is a round of karma. It's a wheel of karma. It's a wheel of suffering. We're caught in it from birth to rebirth to another birth. And he says, don't even think that there's something better waiting for you there. The only thing better than this is to get off the wheel and go to nirvana, where you'll just disappear and be peaceful. So until you get off the wheel, you're going to be trapped in this. All every desire you have will lead, every pleasure you have will be followed by a pain, every success you have will be followed by a failure. And every joy will become a suffering. And therefore, the best thing is to get off the wheel as soon as you can. And this was such a powerful thought at one particular time in the history of India, after the end of the Golden Age, when things came down, that for 800 years, Buddhism was prevailing and denying the most fundamental reality, the greatest discovery that humanity had ever made, which was made during the period of the Vedas and in the Upanishad. The greatest discovery humanity's ever made at any time, and that was the ultimate reality, is an infinite, eternal existence, consciousness, bliss, Satchitananda. With one sweep, Buddha has thrown out the whole thing and said, Satchitananda is an illusion. There's no Satchitananda. There's only a wheel of karma. And having made the greatest discovery, because we live in the mind, the vital, and the physical, the generations, the great-great-great-grandchildren of the rishis of the Vedas and the Upanishad were willing to believe Buddha and come to the opposite conclusion. Shankara came 8 centuries later and tried to salvage the great truth of Vedanta, at least half of it, by saying it's not a void or a nirvana or an emptiness out there. Beyond all of this, Buddha was right. This is all an illusion. But there is a truth, and that truth is Satchitananda, so the sooner, we also have to get off the wheel as quickly as possible. Buddha was right. But instead of getting off the wheel and drowning in an ocean of nothingness, you should get off the wheel and be liberated into an ocean of Satchitananda. Another negation, an ultimate negation. And he saved Hinduism. He saved the fundamental truth of the Brahman from being completely extinguished by this very resourceful explanation. Satchitananda is true. What isn't true is the world. Buddha said what's true is the world, and it's the world of suffering, and beyond that there's nothing. Shankara switched it around and said, what's true is Satchitananda, and the world is an illusion. It's a maya. And through that means, he managed to preserve belief and faith in Brahman, even though he denied and destroyed or abandoned faith in light, faith in the world, and in the destiny of the world. So it served a purpose in its time. Sri Aurobindo has come back to say both are true. Rather, both are divine, and that is the original message of the Upanishads. That is the original truth. When the Ishu Upanishad says all is Brahman, it means all. That man, that lady, that boy, that tree, that flower, that animal, everything is Brahman. Not that everything's an illusion except Brahman. And that is his universal realism. But Sri Aurobindo says, how do we know this for sure? The arguments given by illusionists over so many centuries have dug so deep. How can we really root out the seeds of that it's too good to be true from our minds? How can we really come to believe that the best we hope for or aspire for at any moment is not nearly as good as it could be? That the real limitation for us is not life or reality. The real limitation for us is we're illusionists. We refuse, we can't believe. It's like we've been living in a prison and after so many years the door is unlocked and the jailers go away. And we see the door is open, but we know, no, it must be some trick. I know I'm in a prison and I must remain there. And so even when the jailers have gone, we remain there for the rest of our life in the prison, even though the doors are open and the windows are open. No, no, it's illusion. I know I'm in prison. We refuse to believe that what's waiting for us and what's possible for us and is far better than anything we imagine. That's the message that Sri Aurobindo and Mother have come to deliver. Sri Aurobindo says that there's a certain justification in our cynicism, our doubts, our illusionism. Because we do get disappointed. So when Elizabeth finds out that Charlotte has accepted Collins, she's disillusioned. In fact, Mr. Bennett said, I was thinking that only my daughters are silly girls and that Charlotte's a sensible girl. Now she has shown herself equally silly. So it reconfirms the idea that a sensible girl is an illusion, that there are no sensible girls in his mind. I've been reading a novel about the founders of the Mughal Empire in India, Babur, who started out in Central Asia. At an early age of 12, his father died and he became the king of a kingdom. And at the age of 16 or 17, he led his army. A relative of his died in a neighboring kingdom, and so he went there to claim the throne. He claimed the throne there, and meanwhile, people came and invaded and took the original kingdom where he was. And then a year or two later, somebody else came and invaded and drove him out of the new place. And he ended up living in the mountains for a few years with a small band, just like a tribal leader. And finally he went someplace else, left his home in Uzbekistan or wherever it was, and finally came to Afghanistan. He was a small band. Somebody comes and says, the king of Afghanistan has died, and he has asked that you become the new king. He ends up becoming the king of Kabul. And then finally, towards the end of his life, he leads a huge army to India and defeats the Lodi at Panipat, and he takes Delhi and Agra, and he's the emperor of a huge kingdom. He dies, I think some portion of the, not the roof, but some hanging area falls down and hits him and kills him from the building. And his son, Hamoyan, at an early age, is suddenly the king of this whole territory. And within a few years, he's lost the whole thing. And he's back to the stage of Babur being down to a few hundred retainers. He had 100,000, army of 100,000. He's down to 200. So things like this we see in life. And so they become a justification for the vital idea that nothing is sure and nothing is lasting, and therefore you can't really have faith in anything. But he says, just because there are disappointments, just because there are experiences like this, doesn't mean that doesn't mean that life is unreal, and it doesn't mean that ultimate success is unreal. Rather, what we find is that all our disappointments and all our failures are absolutely essential for our greater future success. They are not proving that our future is failure. They're not coming to tell us to give up hoping. They're coming to give us a knowledge and experience so we can really discover the greater truth. When she tells Darcy that you're the last man on earth I could ever marry, or I would ever marry, I mean, nobody needs a greater discouragement than that. But we clearly see later on that it was those very words that she spoke to him which helped him to qualify to become the happiest man and the first man in the world. It's not in spite of those words, it's because she spoke those words and gave him that experience that he made the effort to become better. So what about you? When you think about your life, when you think about what's happened, what are you telling the people around you when they think big, or they think glorious? What are you telling yourself when Appa says, you can have the 100 crores, you can be whatever you want to be? He says, I shouldn't. If I get too excited, I'll only be disappointed later. It's so deeply ingrained in us. Sure, Bindo's come, he wants to dissolve the illusion of illusionism in our heads, in our way of thinking. He wants to tell us we can be whatever we want to be. We can do whatever we want to do. There's no qualification. There's no limitation. The limitation is we don't believe in. If life is real, if life is divine, then he raises the question, why this ordeal? And that's what I've been trying to explain. The ordeal is the aid for us to come out of the ignorance. The ordeal is the experience we need to convert the imperfection into perfection, as Darcy did. The ignorance into knowledge, as Lizzie did. The frustration we feel, the tension or the pressure we feel, is to raise the intensity of our effort so that we can come out of ignorance and discover the truth and the delight. If you look back on your disappointments and frustrations in life, instead of seeing it, yes, yes, this has taught me to be reasonable, taught me to be sensible, taught me not to get too ambitious or too excited. If that's the conclusion you've come to, we've come to the wrong conclusion. When Lizzie abused Darcy, the right thing that he should understand is not that I will never marry you. The right thing he should understand is, please improve yourself and drop all of those nasty habits and come back to me and propose in the right way, and then I will marry you. That was the message. If Darcy had gone away depressed and said, I could never marry anyone else, she'll never marry me, so it's I should become a clergyman, or I should I should go off into the forest or something like that. I can't. Nothing is good anymore. He's completely misunderstood the experience. Fortunately, he got the message right. He understood the message. Have we understood the message of each of our failures, each of our disappointments, and each of our frustrations? It's a message for us to improve. It's a message for us to get better so that life can show its divinity. But he says, there are more serious grounds on which you can make a case that the world's an illusion. In this chapter, Sri Aurobindo almost seems to be an illusionist sometimes, because he doesn't miss any argument in favor of illusionism. It's like he wants to argue every point from the opposite side of the opposite lawyer so that he can disprove it. I think maybe in the last meeting I mentioned Davin's novel, Justice Juggernaut. I think I mentioned it. No. Huh? I mentioned Gomedy, The Suitcase. I didn't mention this. The other book, it's the only one that's translated into English. Papa asked me to read it. It's Justice Juggernaut. It's a story about a murder. And in the first half of the book, the prosecutor is examining all of the witnesses against the defendant. The defendant's the son-in-law of the man who died, of the eldest, the son-in-law, of the eldest daughter. And all the evidence and all the testimony seems to make it conclusive that the son-in-law has murdered, poisoned the father-in-law by an overdose of sleeping pills. He has the motive, he had the opportunity. He even said that he would like to see his father-in-law dead. And by the time you finish, by the time the prosecutor has finished going through all of the witnesses, everybody in the court feels that the man is definitely guilty, and there's no hope for him. In the second half of the book, the defense attorney starts in calling the witnesses. And he calls a number of the same witnesses also. And each witness he calls casts the light of the facts in a completely opposite way. So what looked to be clear evidence of the intention and opportunity and act of murder, because the son-in-law had sleeping pills which he was taking himself, and he was seen taking a bottle of sleeping pills with him, and the bottle was missing a certain number of sleeping pills, It turns out there were three other people in the house who were also having the same sleeping pills. And it turned out that the man who really did it had gone and bought sleeping pills in order to do it. By the end of the story, you understand that everything you thought was true is false, and everybody you thought was innocent was guilty, and vice versa. Shurabindo's like that. First, he puts the case of the prosecutor and who's making the case for illusionism. And then he comes back and he takes each and every argument, each and every piece of evidence, and he shows that the illusion is an illusion. It's really not like that. One of the common ways in which the argument of illusionism is made is to say, the world seems to be real. It does seem to us to be real. We're here when we're having experiences, they seem to be real. So how do we explain that something that seems to be real is not real? You need a very clever argument for that. So Shankara came up with one. See, when you're in a dream, it also seems to be real to you. When you're in a dream and somebody's chasing you or shouting at you, or when somebody's giving you a pot of gold, or when you're flying or whatever it is you're doing, you're very... When somebody's threatening you, you shout in the dream and you wake up, oh, that was only a dream, it wasn't real. No, but it's very real when we're in the dream. So he says life is like that. As long as you're in it, it looks to be real. But when you wake up, you find out it's not real at all. It doesn't exist. So all I'm trying to do is, Shankara said, all I'm trying to do is get you out of the nightmare. And so you can wake up and see you're not, all of this is not really happening. It's not true. This is one of the arguments that illusionism is giving, that life and the world, which seems so real to us, are only real because it's a dream. And when we wake up into moksha, we'll understand none of it exists at all, none of it is real at all. It's kind of like, for the romantic, on the honeymoon after the marriage, he wakes up and says, yes, it was only an illusion. It was only a dream. I thought she was going to continue to behave this way for the rest of my life. I never knew it was only until the wedding ceremony. But even if, what Shurabindo says is, even if after the marriage, things are totally different than they were before the marriage, doesn't mean that the romance before the marriage was unreal. It only means you are in a different situation now. Just because something we've experienced in the past no longer seems real to us, doesn't mean it's not real. We're in a different consciousness now. About 1973, we'd been living here for a few years, and my aunt came to visit. She was a retired school teacher, and she came in January, and within 2 weeks, mother was there. That's 72, or 73, and on her birthday, she was taken to see mother. And she had a magnificent experience. I may have mentioned my aunt before. She's not a very popular person. She's no longer, but she was not a very popular person in the world. Most people who knew her were happy to not know her any longer. But she had such a magnificent experience with her mother. For a couple of weeks, she was walking around like a saint, with a smile on her face and beaming pleasant to everybody, and she was just in heaven on earth. She was staying in one of the ashram guest houses, and then after 2 or 3 weeks, it wore off, the experience wore off, and she began to come back to normal. And after a month, she said, "I have lost the whole thing. It wasn't really real." So at that time, I took and introduced her to Appa for the first time. And he asked her about her experience here, and she started saying that she'd had such a wonderful experience, but it didn't last, it wasn't really real, it's all gone. He said, "Where did it go?" "No, it's gone, it's lost." He said, "Please tell me what it was. Please tell me when, where you, where, what happened. What happened when you met Mother? What did you do? What did you say? What did happen?" And he asked her to go back through and relive the whole experience, what she was wearing, what flowers she had, what Mother did, what she saw, what she remembered. And by the time she had narrated the whole experience, the whole thing came back to her again. And she felt like she was in heaven on earth. So it's not that the thing was not true. It's just when you move, or it's not even that the thing no longer exists. It's that we have moved to another consciousness where that seems no longer real to us. The joy and delight that the child has in seeing a flower or a puppy dog or a cat or something like that. That childlike wonder, which we lose when we grow up. "Oh, not another cat, don't let the cat in." Is because we have changed. We passed to another consciousness. Doesn't mean that that was unreal. Doesn't mean now I know the truth about cats and dogs and my child, then I was wrong. Then I thought cats and dogs are the most wonderful thing in the world. Now I know that they're only dirty animals and we shouldn't let them in. Who's right and who's wrong? It's a different consciousness. The joy of the child is real. So Sri Aurobindo says, just because when we wake up from a dream, it no longer seems real, doesn't mean that there's no reality to the dream. It only means we're in another state of consciousness where that doesn't seem real to us. When Bingley was dancing with Jane, it did seem real to Jane and to Bingley and to everybody else that they were in love and they may be married. But later on, she convinced herself that it was only a dream and that he never really cared for her. And it would never happen. So the argument is, are dreams real? And one of the things the illusionists say is, that life is like a dream. So Sri Aurobindo says, life is not really like a dream. The idea that the world is unreal because it's like a dream. Life is real, not really like a dream, because you go to sleep in the madras in your house on the bed, and in a dream you may wake up anywhere in the world. You may be floating on a lotus petal in the middle of a lake, or find yourself on a mountaintop or in a mud hole. You never know where. And then when you wake up again, you'll find out that you're not in any of those places. You're back in your bed. So something about dreams is you can never predict what will happen next. If you're in the desert one minute, you may be in the mountain the next moment. If you're inside, if there's alone one minute, there may be surrounded by people the next moment. There seems to be no continuity in the dream. Whereas in life, if you go to bed in your bed in your house in Madras at night, chances are very, very good that when you get up in the morning, you're going to find yourself in the same place. I hope. Because life doesn't have that discontinuity that we see in the dream. Life is predictable. It's consistent, at least at the physical level. If I drop the water bottle, this time it's going to fall. And if I drop it 1,000 times, it's going to fall. Whereas in the dream, it may fall, or it may go up, or it may hang in midair. So the idea that life is like a dream is not really true. I'm going to come to it. She's asking, what is a dream? I'm not going to answer everything. And why do we dream, and what does it symbolize? He talks about dreams in the chapter, so I will come to it. But it's true in life that even though we wake up in the same place we went to bed, it's also true that there's something of a dreamlike character about our lives, because things constantly happen that surprise us. So I got a good news this morning, and now it turns out to be wrong. I was offered an opportunity, now it's disappeared. Somebody said they were going to give me a promotion or a job or an alliance or something, and then turned out to be they changed their mind. So in life also, you can't rely on what happens. It's a common feeling, a common experience. Just at the point when, after Lizzie comes to Pemberley, just at the point when Darcy, so pleasant, invites her in, brings Georgiana, is friendly with the gardeners, invites Mr. Gardner for fishing and everything, just when he thinks and she thinks everything's going to be wonderful, he comes to Lambton Inn the next morning to call on her, and who knows, maybe he was going to propose if he was really courageous, we don't know. She's in tears, the letter from Jane has come, and the whole thing is ruined. So life has this unpredictability to it that makes it feel to us like a dream. So even if physically it's predictable, that unpredictable aspect is there. Maybe there's some truth in it that life is a dream, that you really can't be sure of anything. But Sri Aurobindo says that when you really understand the inner meaning of life, nothing is everything is as sure and certain as the fact that you're going to wake up in the bed where you went to bed the night before. The problem for us is not the uncertainty of life. The problem for us is that we're ignorant of the real inner significance of things. When we really understand life, we will see that life is not like a dream that way. Life doesn't bring things just out of nowhere. Everything is connected and everything has an inner meaning. The problem is we can't understand it just with our sense mind or our physical mind. We have to have that inner knowledge, which is what Appa has been trying to teach us through Pride and Prejudice and his books. Why don't you, if you speak here, then I won't have to repeat it. If you speak here, I won't have to repeat it. have one? A random event. It was connected to your consciousness, and when you changed that consciousness, the ring came back, which is what immediately, which is what Darcy found out when she came to Pemberley. At least he should have. What he understood, we don't know. Which is what Lizzie should have found out when she recognized her contribution to Lydia's elopement, or when Mr. Bennett recognized that he was responsible for Lydia's elopement, Lydia came back married. So even when it appears to be a dreamlike event, unconnected, without meaning, it's simply we don't happen to discover the meaning. There is a meaning. So this, he gives this example to say that the argument that life is like a dream and therefore it's an illusion is not true, because life is not like a dream. Dreams may be illusion, but life is not like that. But he doesn't stop there. Now he comes to Ranjani's question. He says, then what are dreams? And he's going to tell us not only life is not an illusion, but dreams are not illusions either. So even if life were like a dream, it doesn't prove that life is an illusion. It only means that dreams are not illusions either. And that's what he's going to explain. And he tells us there are many types of dreams. Some dreams do have a character which appears to be illusory. But the more we know our dreams, we'll find that some dreams are very, very much real. And the question is, what are they reflecting in the reality? There are all types of dreams. There are dreams that come, the first type of dreams are subconscious dreams. When we leave the waking consciousness and fall asleep, we may think we stop being conscious. We don't stop being conscious. We are always conscious. The question is what we're conscious of. We go from the waking consciousness to the subconscious. And there we have experiences. It's just like the soul after death. For us, The soul is gone and consciousness ends with death. The consciousness of the body may end, but the soul, it never ends. And I have mentioned, I think, Mother talking about experiences of a disciple who died and went back to his room and found they were moving all the furniture out and came running to Mother and said, Mother, what's happening? They're taking all my furniture away. Why are they doing that? Where am I to stay? He didn't know that he had died. He didn't even notice that anything had changed, except that somebody was occupying his room or moving his things around, because his consciousness continues. So like that in dream, our consciousness continues, but it goes to a dark area between the conscious and the unconscious, which is subconscious. And there it has other experiences, many types of experiences. One type of experience it may have is, I ate a lot before I went to sleep. My stomach is very heavy and there's some pain in my stomach. And in the subconscious, I have all kinds of heavy dreams, heavy images that are simply the reflection of my body in the night. If I happen to turn in my sleep and I'm sitting on my side and sleeping on my side and my leg is going to sleep or in an uncomfortable position, I may dream about pain because the body's actually in pain. And I'm not conscious in my body, but subconsciously something is feeling. This doesn't mean the dream is unreal. It only means the dream is reflecting how much food was in my stomach when I went to bed, or the painful position of my leg, which I'm not aware of. Or it may be that during the waking, I was thinking so much about a problem or ideas or things like that. When I go to sleep, I continue thinking about things like that in some way or other. Or somebody told me a story about something good or bad happening during the day, and subconsciously the memory of that comes up and I have a dream along those lines. The dream is not unreal in the sense that it's really based on the food in my stomach or the pain in my leg or what happened during the day. It's not a complete imagination. If I dream something based on what happened during the day, it may be a distortion of that reality. It's not a complete imagination. It's not dreaming something out of nothing. It's a distortion of what happened during the day, what I heard during the day, what I thought during the day. So he says, that doesn't make the dreams unreal. He said, sometimes in the dream we reverse things. For example, if I was angry at somebody or jealous of somebody or didn't like somebody in the day, I have a dream in which that person is chasing me and trying to hurt me. Oh, that person's gonna, and I wake up saying, see, that person doesn't like me at all. I forget it. Actually, I don't like that person. And I've been wishing ill of that person. In the dream, it gets reversed. The dream is unreal in the sense that it's a distortion of the reality, but it's not based completely on what is unreal. And Western psychology, what they call psychoanalysis. Coming with somebody to the center. The dream. So which is real? This is real or that's real? Exactly. So there are all types of subconscious dreams. But there are also, when we dream, we not only can go into the subconscious, we also have a subliminal self, which he has mentioned in the chapters we read earlier. The subconscious is the meeting place between our waking consciousness and the inconscient from which we have evolved. But we have a subliminal consciousness which is universal, which is the meeting place between the superconscious above and the unconscious below. And it's a huge world in which we live, but we're unaware on the surface. It's not a dream world. In one sense, it's more true than the world we live in. The perceptions we have there of reality are truer than the perceptions we have on the surface. So when Wickham comes smiling, charming, and gives her all attention, somebody who's more intuitive and more alert, Lizzie thinks the reality is he's a sweet, good man, but somebody who has greater intuition and knowledge in the subliminal say, yeah, he looks very good, he behaves very good, but somehow I don't think it's real. That's the intuition from the subliminal consciousness, which knows more than we know on the surface. So we can have experiences that are of the subliminal in our dreams. We can have dreams that are subliminal, which are experiences that are true there that we are seeing in the night. We can solve problems in our sleep. We can have warnings, indications of the future, dreams that are really true, predictive dreams. Though you can never be sure from a dream what's real or not, and we should never assume. Larry Page, who was the co-founder of Google, one night he had a dream about making a better search engine. And he woke up the next day and he wrote down his ideas, and that became the discovery of Google that made it such a fabulous success. The knowledge that he expressed came to him originally in a dream, not a subconscious dream, not because he had food in his stomach, but because when he left the surface mind, he went into a deeper realm of knowledge. There was a famous chemist named Kekulé. He had been trying to decipher the structure of a chemical compound, and it was defying all of his efforts, and he was so puzzled by it. One night he had a dream about a snake biting his own tail. And when he woke up, he realized the problem he's having is because this is not a long chain molecule, this is a circular molecule, and he discovered benzene. The man in America who invented the sewing machine, there may be more than one man, but in America there was a man, Elias Howe, who invented the sewing machine. They had tried different sewing machines, but there was always a problem with the thread going in and out at all. And one night he had a dream of a cannibal chasing him with a spear, a needle-like spear. And at the end of the spear, which he was jabbing into him, there was a little hole in the spear. When he was designing his sewing machine, he was putting the hole at the top of the needle. And then he suddenly realized the hole should go at the tip of the needle. And so he invented a very successful sewing machine. Srinivasa Ramanujam said that he didn't solve his problems. He saw saw many of the solutions, the great mathematician, many of the formulas that he discovered came to him in dreams. He just saw them. Those are subliminal dreams where we have a knowledge. There are also symbolic dreams. Sri Aurobindo has written and explained the symbolism of many dreams. I don't remember them all, but one, he says, if you're traveling in a fast train, it's a sign of rapid progress. If you're flying, not necessarily in an airplane, some people fly in their dreams without a plane at all, it means really making fast progress. The swan is a symbol of the soul. And he gives so many examples of what symbolism is. The only thing is he says you cannot say categorically that anything, something can be a symbol for somebody and not for somebody else, so you have to deal with these things carefully. Mother had experiences at night when she was had her eyes closed. In one of those experiences, she saw Sri Aurobindo, and his body was full of bandages. You know, when the disciples were trying to correct his writing and remove the errors, they were wounding his body. She saw it as Sri Aurobindo in bandages. Mother has an elaborate dream that she's mentioned in the agenda, that she was in a huge hotel, and the hotel is constantly being reconstructed. Things are disappearing. Stairway was here 1 minute and it goes. A room that was here 1 minute and it goes. It's constantly rearranging itself, and the owner of the hotel is a mother, and she has a daughter. They're managing the hotel. And she describes the whole thing. And the mother is insisting that the daughter stay in the room, and the daughter is trying to go everywhere and find things. And mother explains, it's a long explanation, that the mother represents the physical consciousness that doesn't want to change. The daughter represents the new creation that constantly wants to rebuild things. It's a symbolic dream. There are dreams from the vital plane or the subtle physical plane that are real experiences that happen in the night. One lady disciple, Sujata, Satprem's companion, she had a dream in which mother came to her in the night. Just looked exactly like mother, but there was some dark spot on her face. And when she saw the dark spot, she began to doubt whether it was really mother. And she told mother the next day, that was a false being that came to her as mother, but because she was sincere, because of her sincerity, she could tell the real mother from the false mother. It was a real experience, not a physical experience. Before I ever heard of mother, about a year before I ever heard of mother, I had a dream one night, we were in California, in which I was walking through a very dark park at night, and it was quite frightening. I felt very insecure, and suddenly out of nowhere, this beautiful woman, older woman appears, and she started talking to me, and I felt so peaceful and so happy. I never knew there was somebody called the mother at the time. And she gave me a mantra. She said, you repeat this and you'll be protected. I remembered it. I knew, wrote it down. And 1 year later, I heard of mother for the first time. I also had another experience. After I came to Pandi and we were in the ashram, and mother was so affectionate. One night I dreamed that mother came to me and she was telling me some very important things. And when I woke up, I couldn't remember anything she told me. So like a young fool, I wrote a letter to mother saying that, mother, I had a very wonderful dream last night. You told me so many things, but I can't remember what they were. They took the letter to mother and read it to her, and mother laughed very loudly. And the word came back, she gave a blessings, and the secretary told me I read the letter to mother, and she laughed. Mother laughed. Why did she laugh at me? Then suddenly I realized how ridiculous I was. Mother has been telling me things, and I don't remember them, and now I'm writing to her asking. Meaning, it's not what she told me in the night. I have already forgotten all the things she's told me before. It's my job to remember them. The dream tells me that I am not remembering what I know of Mother. It's a symbolic dream. So those are there also. There is also a deeper level of sleep, which appears to be dreamless sleep, where we lose completely the contact. We can remember our subconscious dreams. Many people don't. Occasionally we do. Rarely we remember the subliminal dreams. But the deeper dreams, we never remember. To us, it seems like a dreamless sleep. And the reason is that consciousness we are in is so far away from our waking consciousness that we're not able to make any connection. Mother actually says in the depth of that dreamless sleep, we go back to Satchitananda. We go back to pure spirit, but we usually have no recollection of it when we wake up. So, Sri Aurobindo says the idea that dreams, that life is like a dream, and that means life is unreal. First he says life is not like a dream, and now he says dreams are not unreal. So whether life's like a dream or not, it doesn't prove anything about a cosmic illusion. And he even says that you can become conscious of your dreams, and Mother has spoken a lot about this, and that if the more conscious we become of our dreams, the more we will become conscious of ourselves and the significances of our life. It's possible to, many people think that they don't dream, but everybody dreams. When we say we don't dream, it only means that the disconnection between our active sleep night, our waking state, and our sleep state is so much that we don't remember it. But it's possible to go back, and if you take the effort, to remember more and more of your dreams. And the more you try, the more conscious you'll become of your nights. Until you can get to the point where your night is as full as the day of experiences from beginning to end, and maybe more interesting in many cases than the daytime. And actually, they're related to one another. So, for spiritual progress, remembering the dreams and developing them can be very useful. And she gives a method. She says, the key is that when you wake up, you should be absolutely still. The moment you start to move, you break the connection with the dream state. So first, there should be an absolute immobility. You should not think. You should not even pay attention. You should try to look for the thread of the dream which you came from. Sometimes when we wake up, we remember a little tiny fragment of the dream, but we don't remember what was there before. And if you sit there quietly, lying patiently, and catch the thread without thinking, without moving, a little bit more of it, you remember the flash of what happened earlier. You begin to remember what was just where it came from. And gradually, the more you do that, the more you go back. And if you take the trouble of recording the dreams that you remember, even if they don't make any sense to you, and most of them won't make any sense for a long time, you'll find that that effort of trying and the effort of recording, the next time you'll remember a little more. And after a while, you may remember long, long experiences that went on for a long time. And if you get further and further, a time may come when you're able to be conscious in the dream, when you'll not only be aware of the dream, but you'll remember that, you'll know that you're dreaming. Then you can think of Mother even in the dream. And then it becomes a conscious experience for you. So, Sri Aurobindo has concluded from this that the fact that dreams have any similarity to life doesn't support the case of illusionism at all, because dreams themselves are based on an unreality. The theory of illusionism says not that we are having dreams as a distortion of Brahman. The theory of illusionism says that all that we see in the world is totally unreal and has no connection with Brahman. It's not like I have a pain in my stomach and there I dream about something unpleasant. This has nothing to do with that. And therefore, Maya, the creative power of Maya, is totally unconnected with the truth of Brahman. Whereas what we've heard from him is that dreams are not totally unconnected with our life. Dreams are not totally unconnected with reality. They may be a distortion of reality. They may be a symbolic expression of reality, but they are not a total imaginary fabrication. So the analogy of the dream doesn't help us believe in illusionism. It doesn't support the case of illusionism. But there's another argument given by the illusionists, and that is that life is like a hallucination. It doesn't really exist. And so he says we better study and look at what a hallucination is and see whether or not that supports the case of illusionism. And in the illusionists cite two types of examples of hallucination. One of the famous ones is, we see a rope on the road and we think it's a snake. He calls that a mental hallucination, because there really is something on the road. It's a rope, but the mind interprets it as a snake. Then there's something like a mirage. Mirage in the desert, you're thirsty, you've been wandering for days, and suddenly you see an oasis or a city or a waterfall, and it's completely non-existent there. It's a visual hallucination. You think something's there, but it really isn't there. And this is another argument that's often used to say that life is a hallucination. You think I'm here and all the other people are here. We're really not. You think you're here. You're really not. You think that we are people. Really, we're only Brahman. And you have completely projected something non-existent on the Brahman. So Sri Aurobindo says, hallucinations are there, but this doesn't support the case of illusionism. Because even if you see the rope and you think that it's a snake, the rope is real. The rope is not something imaginary. You are seeing the rope and mistaking it for a snake, so we can say you're ignorant. It's not an illusion. It's not a hallucination in the sense that when Shankara says the world is unreal, he doesn't say we are mistaking another world for this world. Maya has created something totally non-existent. The only thing that exists is a formless, infinite Brahman, which never takes any form. No individuality, no action, no movement, no change. So this is totally an imagination, like seeing a snake when there's nothing. And he says, even if you saw a snake where there's nothing, the snake may not be there on the road, but snake is real. Snake may not be here now, but snakes are real. You may see a city in the desert, and the city is not there in the desert, but cities are real. So even your sensory hallucination is not based on something totally non-existent. It's based on something that exists somewhere that you have projected here. So he says, even the idea of hallucination doesn't support the idea that life is non-existent, that the only thing is a formless, featureless Brahman. And he goes through other types of arguments as well. There are other arguments of the illusionists, like we mistake Mother of Pearl? Never heard of it. Mother of Pearl. Mother of Pearl is a type of a shell that looks like silver. Not oyster, not pearl. Mother of Pearl is also a shell that looks like it's silver. Never seen. So I'll tell you another one. When the English sent the colonists to the New World, one of the early colonists went up into Canada because the Spanish had gone to South America and they had discovered gold and silver there. And so they sent so many people to South America to settle it. When the English went to North America, they didn't find any gold or silver. And they were very disappointed and they weren't interested in it. So they sent their ex-convicts let anybody they wanted to get rid of, they sent them to North America because there was nothing there. But one Englishman went to Canada and there he found something that like gold and diamonds. He came back thinking he had found gold and diamonds. But actually the gold he found was what they call fool's gold. Have you ever heard of it? It's a mineral called pyrites, which looks like gold, but it's not gold at all. And he found some quartz crystals and thinking, because he was not well informed, that it was diamonds, huge diamonds that he found. So some of the analogies that are used for saying life is like an illusion are like that. The fool's gold is really a real thing. The quartz is really a real thing. It's not what we think it is. That's not what Shankara is saying. He's saying it doesn't exist. There's nothing there. You simply are imagining it out of nothing. So Sri Aurobindo says, finally, we have to understand all of these ideas that the world is an illusion are based on the notion that mind is capable of imagining something that simply doesn't exist. That we are capable of fantasizing things that are totally non-existent. When Lizzie imagines that Wickham is a good man, it's not an illusion. Wickham is a man. He's a handsome man. He's a charming man. He's a very skillful and clever rogue. Wickham is real. Wickham is not what he appears to be, meaning she's ignorant of the truth about Wickham's character. She's not ignorant about the appearance of Wickham. He really is very handsome. He really is very charming. So that doesn't support illusionism. That only says she's not imagining things. She's only ignorant of the truth of things. And that's what Sri Aurobindo says. The way we see the world is distorted. It's not the way the world really is. The way we see matter, we don't see it is really Satchidananda. We don't see that life is really an infinite force. We don't see the reality of everything, which he saw when he was in Alipur jail, when he had the supermental experience and he saw that the jailer was Krishna and the tree was Krishna. That's not the experience that Arjuna had. Arjuna saw the destroyer, he saw the creator. He saw all the different sides of creation. For Sri Aurobindo, there were no sides. Everything was the divine. Everything, even the destroyer, everything was only the Satchidananda. Even the judge, even the prosecutor, the criminals, everybody. So is the mind capable of total imagination? He says no. Our minds are not an original creator that, like the illusionist says, Maya can create something out of nothing. Our mind always bases itself on something and distorts it into something else. Lizzie sees a very handsome man and she says, anybody that handsome must be good. That's the mind's distortion, but the handsome man is real. So we should understand what mind is and how mind knows things, what mind does. He says mind is an intermediate creator. Mind cannot create a vase or an object of gold. Mind can take gold and convert it into one object or another. Into a vase or a cup or a plate or a spoon or a jewel. Mind cannot originally create anything. It only takes something that exists and sees it, forms it in one way or another. So think about Jane Austen. She's created a story. Of course, we all know that this story doesn't exist, right? This story has lived for 200 years. Is this story real or not real? This story at least has changed my life. I don't know about how anybody... Wickham, we may say Wickham was never born, but the experience that Wickham, the knowledge of what Darcy, the role that Darcy played, or Wickham played in Darcy's life, has given me a knowledge that I never had until then. That even when somebody comes and attacks you with falsehood, There's a truth in it. There's a lesson in it. There's a progress for you to make. So can we say Wickham doesn't exist? Jane Austen wrote 200 years ago, even 2,000 years from now, Wickham will still exist in the, and Wickham will still be there to help people become conscious and know things. We don't know that much about Jane Austen's life, but we know she had she was very affectionate for her sister. Her name was Jane, her sister's name was Penelope or something, I forget. We can't say that Jane doesn't exist. The Jane Bennett in the story and the affection of Jane, of Elizabeth for Jane, is based on something real. It was based on Jane's real affection for her sister. All the characters in the story, none of them may be an exact depiction of anybody who exists. But all of the characters, if she were there today, trying to explain to us how she wrote the story, she would say, when I thought of Collins, I thought of one of my uncles. He was really a very foolish man. When I thought of Lady Catherine, I thought of somebody else. I mixed the names. I changed the names. I changed the places. I put words in the mouth of one person who would come from another person. But none of these characters exist as they are, but all of them I have created out of things that I knew or could experience. I have a theory, completely in my own theory, that why Jane Austen wrote the story the way she did. She says that Lizzie was a romantic and wanted romance. I think Jane Austen was a romantic who wanted to marry for love. But if you see the men she depicts in the story, there's no man who really is very romantic. Darcy, very good, he's handsome, he's tall, he's rich, he's important and all of that, he's honest, but something about Darcy, he never smiles. He never laughs. He's not charming. Wickham is very charming and very clever and very pleasant, but the man's a rogue. Mr. Bennett is informed and wise, but he seems very foolish and also and cynical and sarcastic and all of that. Collins, of course, we need not say more. So why is it that she could not depict any man in the story who would really be her dream image? I thought because she never met a man who she could really be romantic about. So what did she do? She was very clever. This is my own theory. This is my theory of illusion. I think what she did was she tried to take the best of the men that she saw and tried to imagine that man becoming really wonderful. So she imagined Darcy being transformed into a hero. And her imagination, because she's also got Maya in her head, she's also an illusionist, she couldn't quite bring herself to believe that such a perfect man really exists. So finally, when Jane asks her exactly when did you fall in love with Darcy, she laughs and says, I think it was when I saw his beautiful home at Pemberley. Meaning, Jane Austen herself was an illusionist who really could not fully believe in the dream of love, of romantic love. She knew too much. She couldn't fully believe in it and write a perfect love story where really a man and woman were really romantically in love with each other. What happened to the mic? You're asking, does that mean that love doesn't exist? Very good question. Does that mean that love doesn't exist? That's your question, no? It means that Jane Austen, like all of us, is suffering from illusionism. She was not able to construct. She was not able to imagine, based on what she saw, that perfect romantic love, because, like us, she wants to be practical. She wants to be real, meaning she refuses to believe the truth. Appa's writing frequently talking about eternal romance. And he's saying every devotee's marriage can become eternal romance. How many of you believe that? We have a lot of illusionists in the world, I think. Huh? Still searching for it. Where are you searching? In the closet or in the kitchen or in the bag? Eternal romance is real. The fact that nobody's been able to write a love story which really depicts eternal romance only shows that we're all illusionists. If we really understand the message of life divine, if you really understand what Appa has written, you would know that your marriage today, if only I had made a better choice or something like that, or now it's too late, can become that eternal romance if we give up the ignorance, not the illusion, if we give up the ignorance and really, ego. Ego is ignorance. That's the definition. That's the definition. Anyway, my theme was that even when we imagine things, even when mind seems to be creating things, it's not creating out of nothing. It's creating out of our experiences and recombining them in a fashion. I wrote a novel a few years ago. A few of you may know about it. It's on the web. And when I wrote that novel, every incident in the story, every character in the story, represented something that was real to me. Many of them were my own experiences that I put in different circumstances, in different things, in the words of other characters and things. Many of them were people and I had known, but I took some part of this and some part of that. I couldn't make up something out of nothing. Nothing is really made out of nothing. Even the famous science fiction stories. So Leonardo da Vinci, who Sri Aurobindo was, 500 years ago, he drew sketches. He drew one sketch of a device which enabled a man to float in the air. It was a parachute. He drew another sketch of a tank. The tank was only invented in 1915 or 1918. Winston Churchill was one of the people who made it happen. 400 years earlier, Leonardo had drawn a sketch of a tank. A submarine. Something that looks very similar to a helicopter. The famous science fiction novelist Jules Verne, who wrote Around the World in 80 Days, he also wrote a novel, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where there was a nuclear submarine. There were no submarines at that time. He also wrote a novel about a journey to the moon in a rocket. There were no even airplanes at that time, let alone rockets going to the moon. What they created was not something unreal. it was a possibility that had not yet been converted into an actuality. Mind is not capable of imagining something that is not possible. It doesn't mean everything it imagines will happen. But if it wasn't a possibility, mind could not imagine. In our myths and all, we have mermaid. Mermaid is a combination of fish, a fish and a woman, no? It's a combination of two things put together. And then there's an angel, a man with wings, no? There are several others, all a head of a goat, or a lion, the horns of a goat. And when I was in college, I walked into a first day of class in an English class, and the teacher, a very interesting man, he came and he sat on the corner of the desk and he said, "I saw a unicorn on the way to school today." You know, unicorn, horse with a horn in the head. And then he just kept quiet. And after 2 or 3 minutes, one of the students said, "Unicorns don't exist." And he said, "How do you know?" And he went on and on like that for 1 hour, making us ask questions, and he was giving answers, all of which to ask, how do we know when something's true or not? But the unicorn does exist. It exists in our mind as a possibility of a rhinoceros horn and a horse. So mind is like that. Whatever it creates out of combinations of possibilities. Yeah. Let him bring the mic. The very term original thinking is a contradiction. Original thinking means mind originally combines things, not that it invents something totally non-existent. There are ideas. There are ideas that have not yet been expressed. We can call it original thinking. The real origin of everything is supermind. The truths of Satchitananda that want to manifest become real ideas in supermind. And the mind, if it's very receptive, can pick up a hint of one of those ideas. So Sri Aurobindo has said, a yogi sitting in the Himalayas, thinks it was Sri Aurobindo was that yogi, dreams about freedom and the French Revolution comes. The yogi dreaming of freedom is not dreaming something non-existent. He's having a perception of a supermental truth. The revolutionary in the streets of Paris who calls for freedom, he may be thinking originally, but he's receiving the thought of the yogi. So when we say original thinking, what we mean is giving fresh expression to something, giving an expression to something that hasn't been expressed before doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists as a possibility. Say, we can, like Bharati? Because of Sri Aurobindo. He gave original expression to Sri Aurobindo's force, Sri Aurobindo's inspiration in a new form. We can call it original. What did Steve Jobs do? He created the iPod, then he created the iPhone, then he created the iPad. None of them existed before. We can say he was original. But the Walkman, iPod is a very fancy, wonderful improvement on the Walkman. Walkman existed for 30 years. He originally imagined improvements on something that already existed. The phone, he didn't invent. He saw how he could combine the iPod with the phone and how he could use a touch screen instead of buttons. He didn't invent the touch screen. It existed. He improved it. The idea of the iPad, there was the original Newton, which was 20 years or 30, 25 years earlier, the idea of a small handheld computer. Why, it's in the American TV program Star Trek from the 1960s. When I was in college, in the science fiction, they were having small handheld computers like this. They were, nothing existed like that, but they imagined it. It was a possibility. What was a possibility when we were growing up, even now they're having the computer on the wrist, no? Small and phone, cell phone is a, now the wristwatch becomes a phone. In the 1950s, we had a Dick Tracy detective program on TV where the radio was a wrist radio. No such thing existed at that time. But what they saw in imagination was a real possibility. It doesn't mean every real possibility is going to become an actuality. But if it wasn't a possibility, the mind could not perceive it because it's not an original creator. Janani. Janani, please go ahead.
This question. Okay. Priya, who is attending this meeting, she has some issues with the audio. She asked me to ask this question on her behalf. You'd mentioned the Larry Page of Google. Google started from a dream. Her question is, why do some companies and organizations that start off with some huge, very big dream, why do they fail? Why do they not become a reality? If the subconscious is active, where does it lose its clarity and its reality? That's what I'm saying.
Janani, I couldn't hear the whole question. I heard something like, why do some companies start with a big dream and don't become a reality? That was that much I got.
Yes, sir. Yes, that is the question.
Of course, we can ask that question of so many things. That applies to not just companies, that applies to careers, it applies to wedding proposals, engagement proposals, and everything else in life as well. Just because not every possibility becomes a reality. What becomes a reality depends on how we act on the possibility. Steve Jobs, just because iPod was possible, is no guarantee it would happen. If he had done things differently, if he had given up, he may have failed. Just because something is possible for us, the 100 crores is possible for everybody, but it depends on whether we believe in it. Say, look what happened with Mrs. Bennett. When Wickham and Darcy and Bingley and Collins all came to Meryton, all four of them could have married into the family. But Mrs. Bennett activated herself in a way that destroyed the possibility that she had brought with her aspiration. It doesn't mean that she couldn't have had four marriages. But left to herself, she would have had zero. She would have had no marriages at all. Collins went away, Wickham would have run away, and Darcy and Bingley would have never come back. So it's a general question of why do we miss opportunities that are there and convert opportunities into problems because we live in the ego, because we insist on our ignorance and on the ego? That's a general question, a general answer that would apply to companies as well. It doesn't mean the possibility was not real. He said, if a possibility is not real, that is, if it's not based on a sanction of the Supreme, it can never happen. But just because something doesn't happen now doesn't mean that it wasn't possible or that it won't happen later. It will. And just because it doesn't happen to us doesn't mean it won't happen to somebody else who takes the right attitude. If Lizzie didn't want to marry Collins, Charlotte was happy to marry him, and it became the opportunity for her instead. Okay.
Hello, sir.
Yes. Yes, Priya.
Yeah, sir, I just got your insight fully, sir, but I do have a doubt, sir, in that. Can you hear me, sir? Actually, if the sir, you say that the dreams arise from the subconscious mind. So if the subconscious is active, where it loses the clarity, so that the reality we are losing in the end. We are dreaming of a big project or a company or whatever it is. It is arising from our subconscious where it is very active, but somewhere we lose the clarity, so that in the final stage of finishing a project, the reality of the dream is lost, sir. Where is the spiritual link in this? Thank you, sir.
Priya, I'm not able to answer that question more specifically because it's too general a question. I've answered it generally because there's no specific answer to a general situation. Each one is different. As I said, I gave you the example of Mrs. Bennett because it's an example where a real possibility was destroyed by her initiative. That's one example. Unless we take a detailed case, which we can't take now, I can't give you a general answer for it. There are so many ways in which we activate ignorance, in which a real possibility is spoiled. See, Sri Aurobindo said India could have become free in 1912 or 1915. It didn't need to wait until 1947. And India could have become free in 1943 without any partition at all. But the country wasn't ready. The country wasn't receptive for that eventuality. So when Appa says every devotee can have 100 crores, the 100 crores may be waiting. There's a qualification from our side. If it hasn't come, it doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean it can't come. It means from our side, we should fulfill the qualification to make that come. From Darcy's side, when Lizzie said you're the last man on earth, it doesn't mean that she would never marry him and it's impossible. It meant he was not qualified and he had to change himself, and he did. Darcy was the sincere devotee. So I think that's the general answer. The conclusion of this chapter is Sri Aurobindo has examined the theory of illusionism and said all the arguments put up to justify the fact that the world is an illusion are refuted. He rejects them. Whether you say Maya is a dream or Maya is a hallucination or Maya is like the mind, in all cases, it is based on a reality, a possibility, not something totally imaginary, non-existent, which is the theory of illusionism. the end result and the message that I get out of this chapter is not that Shankara was wrong, and that there's no Maya, that we must give up the Maya in our own minds, stop doubting the truth of what Sri Aurobindo has written, Mother has said, and Appa is repeating in every book and every line of every book and in every message. It is all absolutely true. It's not an illusion. Our problem is not with life. Our problem is not that there are no opportunities for us, no possibilities for us. Our problem is only our ignorance. We have to come out of our ignorance. And that is why he's writing this book, to help us understand what the ignorance is that we're in, so we can wake up from the dream to the reality, and the reality is not an illusion, the reality is divine life. Thank you.
Started from mind, dream, and hallucination. So Gary ended up with it, that is, everything is only truth. It is not a dream, hallucination, or trip. Mind, only mind thinks, and mind takes it as a dream and takes it as hallucination. And Sri Aurobindo's words, and we have to accept Sri Aurobindo's words and Mother's words as Appa is writing in every book. And that is the final message he gave in this chapter. On behalf of all the devotees and all the centers, I'm thanking Mr. Gary. Special program, today the special web meeting went well. And once more, I am thanking Mr. Gary.